My name is Ben Burrell, and this is Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings you an in-depth look into each Bob Dylan studio recording record by record. This is the, well, penultimate episode for now of this podcast, because Bob could, of course, always bring out new albums, and we might do a little special down the road. Who knows what's going to happen in life. But for now, the penultimate episode of this podcast, and we're spending it looking at, well, probably one of Bob's worst albums. But as always with this podcast, and I was saying this the other day in a pitch meeting for another podcast, I was saying that sometimes the bad things when it comes to an artist's output are the most interesting things to discuss. Working out where it all went wrong is sometimes as interesting as basking in the glory of something. So we're going to do that. We're definitely going to do that today on Knocked Out Loaded. This is a kind of a little stopgap, if you will, a little kind of break from our Bringing It All Back Home mini series. We shall continue that next week, and we'll have a look at the final songs for that album and the artwork for it as well. Right now they're looking at this mess of an album. Before we do, we need to thank some people who have bought coffees for the podcast. Hello to Roll Blunk. Hello to Sweet Pretty Thing again. Thank you for buying a coffee. Hi to Ed. Thank you so much. Hello to Chrissy and Charlie. Thank you. And thank you to people that have PayPal'd as well. I had a couple of messages from people saying that they prefer to PayPal, which is fine by me. I've re-put that link into the episode's description if that's easier for you. So hi to John Rickman. Thank you for your PayPal. He says, thanks for some great podcasts and congratulations on the arrival of a baby boy. Yeah, thank you so much. You know what, he's doing all right. He's doing all right at the moment. He's sleeping pretty well, I've got to say. It's quite nice to have a little baby in the house again. I did play him up to me the other day as I was changing him. Didn't seem to enjoy it. A lot of crying, which I was disappointed at. I could disown him from the family, but I will give him another chance, don't you worry. Hi to Etienne as well. Thank you for your message. I'm sure I've just butchered another French name. I can only apologise. And thank you for your PayPal as well. As I said, the PayPal link and the link to the Buy Me A Coffee page is in this episode's description. And thank you so much if you have contributed to the podcast over the last few weeks. I had loads of donations, so thank you for them. Right, let's get back to it, shall we? Let's have a look at one of Bob's worst, but it's saved, almost, by one of his best ever songs. Let's go to 1986's Knocked Out Loaded. When the details of what would become Bob Dylan's 24th studio album started to make their way into the public, there must have been a cause for optimism. After 1983's Infidels, there was a feeling that Bob was in a commercial and critical safe harbour after drifting far from shore with LPs like 1981's Shot of Love. This solid ground, though, was continued, although not in the style anyone would have liked, with 1985's Empire Burlesque. While that album had been well received upon its release, its reception had begun to wane almost, well, instantly. And it failed to equal its predecessor's sales figures, too. Here, though, with intriguing collaborations with some very good writers, including Tom Petty and playwright Sam Shepard, and an 11-minute epic on the track listing and a dizzying array of musicians, surely this will be the moment where Bob went from that safe harbour and climbed up another mountain. Could this be a full-throated comeback, his best since Blood on the Tracks, or even his best since Blonde on Blonde? But alas, that wasn't to happen. While we would scale that creative mountain a few years later, before you go up, inevitably, you have to go down even further. As in every great story, our hero has to go through some really bad times to get that happy ending. And here with Bob, believe me, Knocked Out Loaded is a really bad time. It starts out with the most heinous of musical crimes, the bass roll. I mean, sure, used by Barry White in some Lothario-laden masterpiece, it's fine. But here with Bob, it's a no from me. It ushers in the tune, You Wanna Ramble. This song is a reworking of the blues song I Wanna Ramble by Little Junior Parker. It continues Dylan's 70s and 80s love of backing vocals. And not unlike the previous two albums, the production is crisp yet unexciting. While this is a cover, it's a sort of reimagining of the Parker song. In the opening lines of his song, Parker sings, "You know I came here this morning at 3:30. My baby started talking sweet to me. I told my baby, let me tell you something. I want to ramble till the break of dawn." Whereas Dylan in his opener sings, "Well, I told my baby, I said, baby, I know where you've been. Well, I know who you are and I know what league you played in. You want to ramble till the break of dawn." This mirrors that change of the song's differing titles. We go from "I Wanna Ramble" to "You Wanna Ramble." So in Dylan's song, it seems that we're hearing a woman cheating on a man, a blues music staple, of course. Whereas in the Parker version, it's very much a song about a man doing, well, whatever he wants. It's interesting that given Dylan's history of reimagining lines or melodies, to put it mildly, here that process is listed as a cover. Whereas other such borrowing in later years is credited to Dylan and Dylan alone. From here we move to "They Killed Him," which has one of my least favourite production choices, an acoustic electric guitar. It's that sound of nylon sounding strings fed through an amp that makes me unhappy to be a music fan. It's sterile and inelegant. All the 80s production cliches are here on this song, including that reverb on the snare, and it's played on the rim too, giving it that kind of reggae influenced feel. This is continued with the bass line that seems intent on disrupting the flow of the song. However, this is not the worst bit. The worst is the kids' choir. Please, God, no. Kris Kristofferson is the composer of this song, and it's a tribute to his fallen heroes of Martin Luther King and Gandhi and Jesus Christ and JFK and Robert F. Kennedy. Which is fine, but I don't know, for me, the lyrics feel a little bit disingenuous. The album does get a little better, but it's still bad on track 3. This is the Dylan original Drifting Too Far From Shore. It starts out with a drum machine and a synth, which, while not actually sounding that great, feels like it could offer something a little bit different at the start. But before you know it, the stadium rock drums and those backing vocals are back, and we're back in the territory we've been in for a few years now with Dylan. This dates back to Empire Burlesque. And you know, I think at times, if you're just not going to do that great a job with the contemporary sound, why not just go back to your previous sound? At least you've mastered that. It would be easy for me to sit here and say, Dylan really was drifting too far from shore. But, you know, he was. I figure maybe we're even. Or maybe I'm one up on you. What's frustrating about songs like this is if you are going to go for that contemporary sound, at least try and do something slightly different with it. At least try and make it your own. But it seems like there's a real disengagement with the material here. While we've heard from a few sources that Bob wasn't always completely present in the making of albums like Empire Burlesque, here it feels exactly the same. Is this a lack of confidence or maybe just a lack of interest? Perhaps both. Either way, these songs aren't good, but the decisions around them are even worse. At least with this song, you wouldn't say it's plodding, which is ultimately one of the worst crimes in music. That is unlike its tracklist mate, the traditional song, Precious Memories. Now look, I love a steel drum solo. I mean, who doesn't? And I'm all for it being in a Dylan song. But here in this reggae by numbers borefest based on a traditional gospel song from 1925, it is a small light in a cathedral of darkness. Precious sacred season. But wait, this game that Dylan seems to be playing on this record of reducing the LP's quality the further you get through it is about to take a turn for the worse. Track 5, Maybe Someday, is another Dylan original. While its production choices are slightly better than the others here, as in it stays in its lane a little more and doesn't try and dip its toe into another genre just for the sake of it, it commits the cardinal sin of just being forgettable. By the final verse, the uninspired backing vocals start to grate, and the Frisco San Francisco line is kind of terrible. Bob sings, "You said we're going to Frisco, stay a couple of months. I always liked San Francisco, I was there for a party once. Maybe someday you'll see that it's true. There's no greater love than what I had for you." While this is Dylan far from his best, like all good writers, Bob takes us to the depths and then brings us back up. While as the first side of Knocked Out Loaded staggers to a close, we are left wondering if this man we knew and loved, the artist that changed our lives, could ever return. Then track 6 kicks in, and Bob takes us from the bottom of the well and into the stars. As from out of nowhere, he delivers a classic that's so clever and so stunning and so Bobby, it makes you wonder if the whole first side of the album was deliberately bad just to make this even more wonderful, like a long convoluted setup to a great joke. This has happened a few times on Bob's albums, it's fair to say, where songs emerge sparkling so brightly they kind of take you by surprise. Mississippi on Love and Theft, for example. Not that that album was bad, far from it, of course. But that song, for me, has always felt like it comes from some young alternative country music star, not Bob Dylan on his 31st studio album. Same goes for Tight Connection to My Heart, where a slick pop song comes out of a load of dirge around it, or even on the Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid soundtrack, as Knocking on Heaven's Door emerges as a bona fide classic from a collection of easygoing instrumentals and country rock songs. But this is the most stark. This is truly a rose from fertilizer. Bob teams up with playwright of a generation Sam Shepard, and while more often than not these uber collaborations do disappoint, here they craft a 10-minute masterpiece whose force is so strong it not only saves this album from being a wreck, but the other one after it too, just by proxy.
Well, there was this movie I seen one time about a man riding across the desert, and it starred Gregory Peck. He was shot down by a hungry kid trying to make a name for himself.
This is a full-blown drama. Bob's not really a tidy narrative writer, but he does know a good story. There's not a traditional beginning, middle, and end structure to his work, but I don't think that interests him. So it's a loose kind of drama where Bob throws us lines like, strange how people who suffer together have stronger connections than people who are most content. He takes us on an emotional trip through a long gone relationship where he sings, well, I keep seeing this stuff and it just comes a rolling in, and you know it blows right through me like a ball and chain. You know I can't believe we've lived so long and are still so far apart. The memory of you keeps calling after me like a rolling train. Later he tells us he's with someone else now, but he can't help reminiscing. He sings, well, we're driving this car and the sun is coming over the top of the Rockies. Now I know she ain't you, but she's here and she's got that dark rhythm in her soul. This leads up to a stunning chorus that feels like it could power an entire country with its force. But it's not just a love-lost storyline that's going on here. At times, the writers even take a mirror to themselves. Oh, if there's an original thought out there, I could use it right now, Dylan sings, which intentionally or not painfully highlights the surrounding album's carnival of mediocrity. In fact, just on this, when asked about working with Bob, Sam Shepard said, Dylan is not like working with anybody else. With Dylan, you're continuing on this hunt for what he's after, for who he is, this continual mystery about his identity. Which also sounds like the sort of thing Shepard was trying to capture when he joined the Rolling Thunder Review Tour. He goes on to say, we tossed around a bunch of ideas, none of which really got anywhere, and then we just sort of started telling stories to each other. One of the stories that he began was actually the first line of the song. He says, one day I was standing in line for this Gregory Peck film, and I said, why don't we just use that as we're not getting anywhere? The film was, of course, Bob seeing The Gunfighter. They were going to build an epic song of the West with a shifting perspective. Shepard was impressed by the way Bob came up with the images. He says, he has a surprising mind, and you are going down a dark alley and all of a sudden you see this sunlight from him. It's not the usual track of thought. There were many verses with unusually long lines, and I think the most surprising thing is his phrasing, he adds. I'd say, but how the hell are we going to fit this into the melody? And Bob would just say, don't worry about it, I'll make it work. And of course, he did. That's why there's so many constant references to Gregory Peck in this song. The movie motif also kind of informs the song's reflection too. While our narrator is reminiscing about a former love, he seems to do it as little clips, romanticized mini home movies, if you will. The song itself comes from the ashes of an Empire Burlesque offcut, which in turn was inspired by a Woody Guthrie song. The Woody Guthrie song is called Danville Girl. In it, our narrator gets on a train. He seems to be the travelling type. So he rides a, quote, old freight train that carries an empty car. He goes to Danville, where he gets stuck on a Danville girl. Bet your life she was a pearl. She wore that Danville curl. Eventually, though, like every drifter, he leaves. As we know, there's a similar space in between lovers in the eventual track on Dylan's album. And while the songs do share themes, it's not a rewrite from Bob, for once. And it's not like they're twin songs either. They share DNA, but ultimately they are only distantly related. Before Danville Girl is converted to Brownsville Girl, though, it goes through the process of being New Danville Girl. This is the song that Dylan works on Empire Burlesque. It, like the Knocked Out Loaded version, features a ramble from our narrator. Kind of Bob spitting brilliant yet ridiculous observations after a bottle of whiskey. That type of vibe. In this version, though, I actually prefer the production, which is saying something. I hated the Empire Burlesque sound. It was bloated and boring, hair rock with no nuance. But actually here it shies away from that somewhat, and is actually downplayed compared to its regeneration on Knocked Out Loaded.
Well, I keep seeing this stuff and it just comes rolling in. And it blows right through me like a ball and chain. You know, I can't believe we've lived so long and are still so far apart.
What's interesting with these songs like this is we see Dylan's creativity, or at least his method, in real time almost. So on the earlier cut we had the lyrics, I've always been an emotional person, but this time it was asking too much. If there's an original thought out there, oh, I could use it right now. And in the final version we get, now, I've always been the kind of person that doesn't like to trespass, but sometimes you just find yourself over the line. Oh, if there's an original thought out there, I could use it right now. See how Dylan dresses up the emotional person bit? Perhaps he felt it was too on the nose, or that it was just better to use more, I don't know, metaphorical, shall we say, language. Either way, it's fun to see the artist at work, and is possibly Dylan singing about his own artistry. By his own admission, he was struggling with inspiration in these years. Here he could be singing about that. He's looking for an original thought, as we've seen. He's reflecting on the person he was. Perhaps he feels like the old movies, those sorts of memories, ideas and images are flickering away in his head. After the colossal strength of Brownsville Girl, Dylan fans must have been collectively rubbing their hands together for the next track. I mean, if the Sam Shepard collaboration produced that, then what will the Tom Petty collaboration produce? Sadly, it doesn't live up to expectations. I mean, it's not bad, it's fine, it's just not a work of genius. That chugging rhythm and yet more backing vocals, these ones work better than most of the others here. There's some nice slide guitar on the track and some nice noodling too, before Dylan tells us, well, if you don't want to see me, look the other way. You don't have to feed me, I ain't your dog that's gone astray.
But I'm going off to Libya, there's a guy I gotta see. He's been living there 3 years now, been a long refinery.
The album closer is in a similar ballpark to this. Under Your Spell is once again fine. I could do without the awful drum sound, but the shift in chords is kind of interesting. It's not very Bob-like, even though the music appears to have been written mostly, if not all, by him. But the F-sharps and the D minor switching to an A minor and the D majors offer a nice bit of travelling in the chord sequence. The track is a co-write with Carol Bayer-Sager, who is one of the best songwriters of all time. She's written some incredible songs with some incredible artists. Her CV, or resume, to our American listeners, is full of collaborations with Neil Diamond and Michael Jackson, Aretha Franklin, and The Cause. Forget that last one. She wrote some bona fide classics like Groovy Kind of Love, and the best Bond theme, in my opinion, in the form of Nobody Does It Better. By the way, see a Ben's Era Radiohead cover for a killer version of that song. But her experience with Bob was, unsurprisingly, weird. She says, he's the one person that is probably the least collaborative person in the world. Collaborating with him was strange because it was like trying to read off someone's test. But they were covering their test and I'm going, well, what do you think of these words? And he's sort of mumbling something and I don't know, it just didn't make sense to me. She explains she wasn't comfortable taking credit for writing the track, but Dylan insisted she was credited. She says, I would say, what about this? And I would think, he's writing it down. And then I'd look at his paper later and say, can I see? And he had a totally different line written down than the one that I suggested. I said, Bob, I don't feel right about taking credit for anything on this song. He said, no, I wouldn't have written it if you weren't here. Which sounds like a classic Bob story.
Something about
By the time these two final songs finish off Knocked Out Loaded, it doesn't seem so bad. But then again, the moment you hear something else from Dylan's career, you realise this album is a dud. It's not a case of Bob's worst is still better than someone else's good. Make no mistake, this album is definitely bad. While the songs, for the most part, are weak, it's not an album that actually angers me as much as, say, Empire Burlesque or even Under the Red Sky. Now, those albums are definitely better than this one, but you feel those albums had the potential to be good, whereas this is just as bad as it should be, if that makes any sense. The big saving grace is, of course, Brownsville Girl. Without it, there would be no redemption here whatsoever. But with it, it kind of becomes the album and the album only. They might as well have just issued it as a single alone. If they had, it would have been a highlight of Bob's singles output, no doubt. But here, it's kind of like a flower in the dirt, which makes it seem even more beautiful. And this could be me being over-romantic, but you know what? I'd go through 20 albums of below-par material to get to something half as good as Brownsville Girl. So in a way, we should be thankful for this album, even if it is really bad. That's it for this episode. As always, thank you for listening. We shall go back to Bringing It All Back Home next week and take a look at the final songs on that wonderful, wonderful album. As I said earlier, we'll also take a look at the album's artwork too. Join me for that. In the meantime, take care. I'll see you soon.